You are Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast on the Houston Rockets, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome in to a joyous end-of-the-week episode of Locked On Rockets, your home for podcast analysis of all things Houston Rockets basketball. As always, I'm your host, Ben DuBose, Rockets correspondent with Sports Talk 790, the team's official radio flagship in Houston. As we chat this Friday, the Rockets are gearing up for their preseason finale tonight in Memphis. We'll have coverage of that over the weekend, recapping whatever we learn. The Rockets appear to be treating it as a bit of a dress rehearsal. Not all their regulars are guaranteed to return. Eric Gordon's still questionable with the Achilles soreness, but most of the others that have been out, including Carmelo Anthony, who sat out Game 4 due to rest, Clint Capela with the bruised hand, your regulars are expected to play for the most part in Memphis, treating it as a dress rehearsal, which is something that I've been suspecting for a while. Tuesday against the Shanghai Sharks didn't really make sense for guys that had any injuries at all to push it. Well, tonight in Memphis is a great opportunity. We'll see what happens. The main thing, of course, is to hope that you get out building some continuity, building some chemistry, but also coming out of it healthy. The game in Memphis last year was actually the one in which Chris Paul bumped his knee last October and ended up missing most of the first 15 games of the season with that bruise. So we've got that to look forward to in the hours ahead, and if you come back tomorrow over the weekend, we'll have a full recap of whatever we learn. Today's show is going to be a little broader. We're going to try, with the season starting less than a week away, kind of an around the NBA concept, if you will, in which we bring you several league-wide stories and break down what the Houston impact of each is. In today's show, what we're going to be talking about first and foremost is the Jimmy Butler standstill in Minnesota. Then we're going to flow into the MVP race and what James Harden's chances are this year of going back-to-back with the MVP award. And then we'll finish off with buyout candidates, because it seems every week there's a question of, is it Trevor Ariza? Is it someone else? We know the Rockets are well-positioned on the buyout market for January, February, whenever that gets going, because they didn't spend their mid-level exception this summer. But who's actually going to be a candidate going into the season? I'm going to break down who is, who isn't, but more so what the thought process is going to be and what you should be watching for during the season if you want certain players to theoretically be available once we get into January and February. But to start the show, our first segment, let's discuss the Jimmy Butler standoff, because that to me is pretty clearly the storyline that's driving the most traction in the NBA. Thursday, the Wolves canceled practice after Wednesday's circus act in which Butler did practice, according to some reports, teamed up with a bunch of third stringers and beat the first team, all the while cursing out Karl Anthony Towns, Andrew Wiggins, insulting Tom Thibodeau, GM Scott Layden, etc., etc. Thursday, Minnesota had a practice scheduled but didn't go through with it. However, according to some reports, they did have a players-only meeting. Now, even that's in question, because some of the players said that there wasn't one, but Jimmy Butler told ESPN's Rachel Nichols that there was, so I'm going to take Jimmy at his word. And apparently in that one, he aired his grievances towards the front office, but also indicated a willingness to, at least for now, play with the team, because with the regular season less than a week away, you have to be open to the fact that, yes, Jimmy Butler could be on the Minnesota roster by the time the regular season tips off in the middle of next week. So as far as where we're at, obviously nothing has changed. Jimmy Butler wants out. It's a matter of the deal making sense both for his desires and Minnesota's, and the other team feeling they have a decent enough chance to retain Jimmy Butler to make it worthwhile to send out the assets that Minnesota is hoping for. So it's trying to mesh all of these desires together in one deal. It's taking some time. In a perfect world, I think Tom Thibodeau wants to keep Butler because, look, when he's healthy and right, he's potentially a top 10 player in the game. And they also know what they gave up to get him from Chicago last summer. And I don't think they want to take the PR hit of trading him for substantially less in return than what they gave up a year ago, because it was a big deal for Minnesota, got them to the playoffs for the first time in over 10 years, and then to have to effectively swallow their pride and make a bad deal a year later, that's tough. And with the egos involved, we've gotten to what now is a standstill, to where at least all sides, uncomfortable as it may be, have to be open-minded to the possibility of Jimmy Butler opening the season with Minnesota. Now, what does that mean for the Rockets? Certainly, I don't believe the Rockets are out of the running. It's been reported by a lot of sources, Adrian Wojnarowski of ESPN nationally, Mark Berman of Fox 26 locally in Houston, that the Rockets have been aggressive going after Butler, that they've made a strong push. However, all the traction the last 2 weeks has seemed to be between Minnesota and the Miami Heat. What are the reasons for that? I don't know. I think it's pretty clear that the Houston offer would have to start with Eric Gordon, because to get to Jimmy Butler's $20 million salary figure, you have to send out close to that in terms of Houston salaries. It's tough to make the math work without sending Eric Gordon. And beyond that, there have been reports, Stefano Fusaro of ESPN reporting, that the Wolves are seeking both Gordon and P.J. Tucker, which would mesh almost perfectly with the $20 million salary figure. However, it doesn't really make sense for the Rockets, in my opinion, because you're giving up, with both Gordon and Tucker, 60-plus minutes of production, two of your top five players, all for a guy in Butler who it's not even guaranteed that he would stay with you after one season. According to the Fusaro report, the Wolves did re-engage the Rockets this week, but were still seeking both Gordon and Tucker, and the Rockets are unwilling to include Tucker in the deal. I would say that meshes with everything I have heard as well. I can't imagine the Rockets dealing both of those players, with Jimmy Butler being the only rotation piece coming back. But as far as the odds of a deal getting to the finish line between the Wolves and the Rockets, it's pretty clear that momentum has trended in the direction of the Miami Heat the last 2 weeks. According to Wojnarowski, that's the only team Minnesota has consistently been in talks with. And it was to the point late last week where they actually exchanged medicals, to where they were so optimistic a deal would get done that they gave the Miami Heat front office, led by Pat Riley, access to Butler's medical information, which is typically a precursor to a deal being finalized. Ultimately, it wasn't. According to some reports, it got so emotional that when Minnesota came back to the table on Saturday, the Heat effectively thinking the deal was about to be finalized and Minnesota seeking more draft picks, that Pat Riley uttered an expletive at Tom Thibodeau and hung up the phone. And as far as why Minnesota has been wanting to deal with Miami only, there's a lot of possibilities. Maybe they really like Josh Richardson as a young prospect. Maybe they just don't want to send Jimmy Butler to a Western Conference team under any circumstances. They want to give him to the East. Maybe they've been trying to do a favor to Jimmy Butler and or his agent by sending him to Miami, which according to a lot of reports is the team at the forefront of his preferred destination list. There's a lot of possibilities. It could be a combination of those things. But regardless, the underlying fundamentals have pointed to a deal between Minnesota and Miami, and yet that hasn't happened. And as far as where the Rockets are at, it's a weird place in that I don't really think the Rockets are going to magically improve their offer one day. There's not really an incentive for them to do so, especially with the regular season about to start. And at this point, I think the Rockets have explored it enough, not just between Houston and Minnesota, but I'm sure Daryl Morey has canvassed the league looking for potential third team and fourth team partners. They know what the landscape is. And at this point, it's about whether the Timberwolves come back to the table. And again, there was a report this week from Stefano Fusaro that that's exactly what they did, and decide that the Rockets might be a better option for them than Miami. Nonetheless, as I stated, the last 2 weeks, it seems clear that the underlying fundamentals, when you're looking at the various reports, point to a Minnesota-Miami deal, and there's clearly an underlying reason for Minnesota to move him, to have a sense of urgency to get this to the finish line with someone, and that's the fact that Butler can leave them next summer for zero compensation. Because the longer this drags out into the season, I think it hurts Minnesota's leverage, because the teams that would be acquiring Butler wouldn't have him for the full season to integrate, so I think that would drop the price. And I don't buy the idea that Minnesota could wait until next June or July and then trade him, because it's not going to work in June. Jimmy Butler's going to be 30 years old. I don't really view him as an opt-in candidate. He wants to get paid. He's got some mileage. He's had a few injuries. I don't see him opting in to the final year of his existing deal to facilitate a trade. Wherever he goes, I think he's going to want to get that Supermax contract, that $150 million guaranteed next summer, so I don't really see him as an opt-in candidate. And I also don't see a sign-and-trade next July as realistic, because there's going to be so many teams with cap room that really Minnesota doesn't have much leverage in those scenarios. There almost certainly will be options for Jimmy Butler to walk into max salary slots, not needing Minnesota's help. So the incentive is there for Minnesota to get a deal done, and sooner rather than later. There are just some ego considerations that I think are in play right now. I mentioned wanting to recoup the value they gave up last summer to get Butler out of Chicago. I think that's a factor. I think not wanting to appear bullied by Jimmy Butler, especially after the theatrics of this week. I think that's a factor. I think Tom Thibodeau not really wanting to rebuild, wanting some win now pieces, I think that's part of the equation. Perhaps also wanting to make a case to Glenn Taylor, the owner of Minnesota, that he wants to keep his job and to give him reasons to keep him around. There are a lot of potential reasons for this standoff, and at this point, I think Minnesota has some trepidation to do a deal because they don't want to make a signal that effectively they gave in after everything that Butler put them through this week. So I do think both sides are getting ready. Maybe there's posturing with it, but they're getting ready for the possibility of Butler actually being on this roster when the regular season opens next week. And as far as the Rockets are concerned, I think Daryl Morey has done all he reasonably can, and it's just waiting to see what the next move from Minnesota is. That said, the case for optimism, if you're a Rockets fan and you are wanting Jimmy Butler, and I've said before, look, I want him because when he's right, he's a potential top 10, worst case, top 15 player. Eric Gordon isn't. I love Eric Gordon. He's a great fit, very good player. Chemistry is great. He just doesn't have the upside, especially in terms of two-way play, which is what you need against the Warriors, a defensive stopper and difference maker like Butler can be. Gordon just isn't at that level. So I think the Rockets, if they can get a deal done with Gordon as the only rotation piece going out, they have to do it. And the case for optimism is that even though the fundamentals point to Minnesota and Miami, the fact is you do have all of these other desires in play. And at this point, if there's bad blood between the Minnesota and Miami front offices, I was saying earlier, citing the report that Pat Riley uttered the expletive at Tom Thibodeau and hung up the phone last weekend after that deal almost was finalized. Maybe with Butler going so public this week, there's a desire not to give him what he wants. I mentioned earlier, maybe at some point a consideration was trying to meet his desires in terms of the list from Butler and his agent. Maybe now they don't want to do that after how Butler has publicly bullied the team over the past couple of days, send him somewhere else just for the sake of making a statement. Maybe it's showing Miami that, no, I don't have to accept whatever you're offering. I have other options. The point is that while I think it's clear at this point that Minnesota on paper would prefer a deal with Miami, whatever the reason, over Houston, there are also legitimate reasons why, despite their huge incentive to get a deal with Butler done sooner rather than later, a deal hasn't been done. There are egos involved. There are emotions. Not all of the people acting are being 100% rational. And because of that, the Rockets, they're lurking. There's nothing new that I am told on that front. But the longer this drags out, the more the Rockets just hanging on the periphery of these talks gets interesting. And it especially gets interesting when October 31st gets here, because that's the day that Brandon Knight and Marquese Chriss will each have been Rockets for 60 days, which means they can be combined, aggregated, whatever it may be, with other players in the same deal. So be it sending one to Minnesota for salary reasons, or maybe they like Marquese Chriss's upside as a lottery pick from 2 years ago. Maybe there's a three-way scenario in which the Rockets or another team absorb the bad Gorgui Dieng contract from Minnesota. The point is that once October 31st passes, the Rockets, because that 60-day clock expires, have more options because they are able to aggregate those guys, Marquese Chriss and Brandon Knight, in trades. The other reason I'm curious, P.J. Tucker doesn't really make a lot of sense to me for Minnesota. To me, P.J. Tucker is the type of piece similar to Andre Iguodala in Golden State, in which he has much more value for the team he's on than others around the league. Because a 33-year-old P.J. Tucker who isn't going to suddenly become a dynamic scorer, he makes sense as a glue guy, a role player on a contender. For a middling team like Minnesota, I know Tom Thibodeau loves defense, and maybe he sees P.J. Tucker as the perfect culture guy for his system. I suppose there's that. But from a practical standpoint, P.J. Tucker does nothing to move the needle for Minnesota. He does for Houston. So my guess is that Minnesota insisting on Tucker, it's less about P.J. specifically, and it's more a theoretical thing to make sure that the Rockets are giving a peak offer. To be giving, basically, Tom Thibodeau wants the Rockets to pay to get Jimmy Butler, potentially a top 10 or top 15 player. I don't think it's about P.J. specifically. I think it's more the fact that, theoretically, Minnesota wants to extract everything they possibly could from Houston or whoever the suitor is. And the reason that interests me, if PJ himself isn't really the draw, and again, I don't really see that a 33-year-old PJ Tucker moves the needle for Minnesota, then maybe the longer we go into this, and as the Rockets get more options, we mentioned Brandon Knight, Marquise Chris being able to be traded after October 31st, which is just 2.5 weeks away, maybe there are substitutes, be it Knight or Chris, be it the involvement of a third or fourth team that conceivably could bridge the gap from Gordon and Tucker to Gordon and something else filler that is not PJ Tucker. Because I just have a hard time seeing PJ Tucker being that valuable for the Wolves in their specific situation. And if that's the case, there might be a roadmap to where you can include other guys to make that work. So to sum up, I don't think the Rockets are in a great spot. I think the underlying fundamentals still point to something between Minnesota and Miami. There's a reason that Minnesota's talks have been focused almost exclusively on the Heat over the past couple of weeks when they've been really focused on finding a solution to this mess. But the longer it goes without a resolution, and the more you hear about bad blood between Minnesota and Miami, the more you have to be open-minded to other scenarios. And also, the closer we get to October 31st, the more options open up for the Rockets and GM Daryl Morey. So while I don't think there's anything imminent regarding Butler and the Rockets, it's enough to pique my curiosity. I think it should yours as well, just to keep an eye on this as the weeks move ahead. Because if there's one thing that you should know about the Rockets, GM Daryl Morey is not afraid, even if it takes until the season. I don't think he's going to say, well, the chemistry, throwing this guy into the mix in the middle of the year. No, if he can get Jimmy Butler and he views Jimmy Butler as the top 10, top 15 talent that I and a lot of us appear to based on the receptions on Twitter, then yeah, I think Daryl Morey's going to make that move. He's not going to back away. Some other teams might. So the longer this goes on, the more I think the Rockets do have a path to where at least it's a possibility as far as whether they can do it. Stay tuned. Now, we had a bit of a long opening segment because the Jimmy Butler discussions are so interesting on so many levels, but that's not the only national NBA storyline to watch with the Rockets as the regular season gets ready to get underway just 4 short days from now when it tips off Tuesday night, ring night for the Golden State Warriors, now two-time defending champions. And as it pertains to the Rockets, another storyline that's getting pushed a lot these days is the MVP race. And of course, James Harden, the defending winner, looking to make it back-to-back. And on paper, especially coming off a game in which he scored 37 points in 31 minutes against the Shanghai Sharks, 9 of 14 from 3. Yeah, he looks at MVP form. He looks ready to go. From everything I've seen, he's in great shape. And on paper, yeah, Harden could absolutely make it back-to-back, which is something that hasn't been done in quite a while. In fact, I think it hasn't happened since Steve Nash won it back-to-back under Mike D'Antoni in Phoenix. Or actually, sorry, scratch that. I'm somehow blocking out the Steph Curry back-to-back from a few years ago. I, like a lot of us, I tend to block out the Warriors when I can. But yeah, getting back to the point, it would be nice if Harden could win it again. Personally, though, I'm skeptical, and there are a few reasons for that. First, I think the far and away choice for the NBA these days is LeBron James. LeBron in LA, it's a perfect storm on so many levels, and I think the NBA would love for him and the Lakers to have the high visibility season that they're counting on. It's great for the NBA when the Lakers are relevant, and so I think there's going to be a bias towards LeBron James if he delivers the way a lot of folks expect him to. And I do think being in LA, a new city, a new setting, he's going to be more energized over the 82-game grind than he would have if it was just another year in Cleveland. So I think LeBron is justifiably the favorite. But I think the real thing to keep in mind as it pertains to Harden and really all the MVP discussions is that around the league, it's become more of a narrative-driven award. In that these days, you don't just come off the radar from off the radar during the season to win the MVP or make a legitimate push. Generally, the guys who can win it, you know by, I would say, at the latest, Thanksgiving. It's set in motion very early. Go back to 2 years ago with the whole Westbrook thing. Yes, I mean, he averaged the triple-double, which was a cool statistical accomplishment, but really, his narrative was put in motion from the moment Kevin Durant left the prior July 4th, because Westbrook was part of the big three in Oklahoma City. Now, all of a sudden, he was the only star left. It's a small market, and so now that KD left him, it's this small market that everybody thought was about to roll over and die, and all of a sudden, if he can rescue them, then yeah, that's an incredible storyline. And so the wheels from that, yeah, the triple-double was probably what got him the final votes to nudge him ahead of Harden, but in terms of him being a serious candidate, it was set in motion well before that. And with Harden, to some degree, The same was true. Once it became clear in training camp that the Rockets were going to be a lot better than expected, keep in mind, the year before, they were 41-41. Some folks in the offseason thought they might even miss the playoffs. Then it was pretty clear that he was going to get a shot at being MVP. The narrative was there. And also, there was this idea that he had been shorted a couple of years ago against Stephen Curry when he arguably deserved to win it, but did win the Players MVP. But the point is, these narratives, they're set in motion well before, and last year it worked to Harden's favor because I think a lot of voters felt bad about the fact that he had two MVP-worthy seasons of the past 3 years, but finished second both times, first to Curry, then to Westbrook. I think there was this kind of this sense that Harden was owed one. And then when Chris Paul, as we mentioned earlier, bruised his knee in the preseason and missed the first 15 games, and yet the Rockets still got off to a great start, and they also jumped from a 55-win team the year before to a 65-win team. It was the perfect storm in which, you know, the team made another move upward in the standings. It was an opportunity to right the wrongs of Harden being left off the prior two or two of the past 3 years in terms of actually winning the MVP award. And with Chris Paul out, there wasn't anyone else to credit the success to, if you will. It was Harden's team, and that was made clear from the start. This year, there are some headwinds against Harden that weren't there a year ago. Most notably, the team, in that a year ago, I mentioned they were coming off a 55-win season, which was great, but you could be better. They were not at that true juggernaut contender level. Well, now I know what the expectations have been. I know what the narratives are, but look, things are going to get framed around the fact that the Rockets won 65 games a year ago, and unless they win 70-plus, which not impossible, but pretty unlikely, you're not going to be better than you were a year ago, at least by the record. Now, you could conceivably be better in certain other ways, but you're not going to see that big move up in the standings the same way you did to where the narratives want to credit something as being different here in Houston. In effect, it would be a continuation of what got Harden the MVP last year. And some will argue, and conceivably, I'm sure he would get some votes, that, well, if they're continuing what they did last year, in which they won 65 games, when the NBA's best team over 82, why shouldn't he win it again? And you could argue that. However, just being real, I don't expect it, because I do think there are some factors that work against Harden. Most notably, fair or unfair, and I think it's very unfair, I think it's pretty clear that nationally some folks find his game not aesthetically pleasing. I was forwarded a podcast yesterday with Bill Simmons and Ryan Russillo, in which Simmons mentioned that he was fatigued as far as the Harden vote even before he won MVP. Russillo mentioned that he's very boring to watch live. I don't agree with that, but I think it's pretty clear over the years that for whatever reason, there is hesitation from people nationally to embrace James Harden's style of play. So if it's close, I think that's played a role in why Steph Curry and Russell Westbrook won those two MVPs over Harden, because their styles of play are viewed as more friendly, I guess, aesthetically pleasing to the league as a whole. There's that factor. There's the fact, as mentioned, that the Rockets are coming off a 65-win season, so there's not that much upward mobility to surprise in the standings. They're also going to have Chris Paul, knock on wood, assuming no injury tonight, ready to go from the outset of the season, so you're going to see a little bit more balance, I would say, in terms of the Rockets' attack this year. And finally, I also don't think the Rockets are going to promote Harden as much. I think this past year, the Rockets organization was on the forefront of pushing the Harden MVP train because Harden's their guy, and they felt so bad about the two prior years, 2015 and 2017, in which he clearly deserved MVP in their eyes and didn't get it, losing to Steph Curry and Russell Westbrook. Now that he's got the MVP, would it be nice for him to win it again? Yes, but ultimately, at this point with the Rockets, everything is about winning a title, so I don't think you're going to see Gerald Morey, Mike D'Antoni, Tillman Fertitta, the people around the organization pushing the Harden MVP narrative in every single interview. At this point, I think it's all about winning a title. If they can get Harden another MVP, great, but I don't think you're going to see them push it as hard. And then when you combine it again with the lofty win total from a year ago, the fact that for whatever reason, folks nationally don't seem to think Harden's game is aesthetically pleasing, all the other little signs that are there, I think it's very hard, not impossible, but very hard to see James Harden win this award again. I hope he proves me wrong. I would never count him out. But in this case, with it being somewhat of a beauty pageant, I just don't think the narratives set up quite as well for Harden as they do for a few others. I mentioned LeBron James being at the forefront of the list for a lot of reasons in terms of who the league wants to win the award. I would also keep, or the voters, I should say, I would also keep an eye on Kawhi Leonard in Toronto, only because I think, A, Kawhi Leonard is, he needs a very big season. He's entering free agency, coming off a year in which he plays nine games, so he has every incentive in the world to be out there and look fine physically. And beyond that, Toronto, if they can make it work, if Toronto, who has underachieved for so long, can all of a sudden make this marriage, what seems so awkward at first, with Kawhi work, if they surprise to the upside, if Kawhi, a guy who everybody ticketed to LA or some other big market destination, all of a sudden finds himself again in relative small market Toronto, to me, that's something to kind of keep on the radar screen. I think LeBron is the forefront of the list, but if you're looking for someone off the radar, I could see Kawhi making a push as well, because I think that a lot of folks are wanting that scenario in Toronto between Kawhi and the Raptors to work out. And if it does, I think he could quickly rise up the list as well. With Harden, I think it's very possible he's deserving of the MVP, but for a lot of reasons, I'm skeptical whether he would actually get it. Now, closing out the program, led off discussing on our Around the NBA theme show, the Jimmy Butler standstill in Minnesota, and the Harden MVP race, where the hot list are, so to speak, entering this season. The last item I want to discuss is the potential for buyout candidates. Now, no one's going to get bought out anytime soon, because it's day one, or not even to day one at this case. But I do think it's important, with the games about to start for real in a few days, to remind folks of what to look for as the landscape starts to take form for what could happen in January and February. And as a reminder, the Rockets are well-positioned because they didn't use their mid-level exception this summer. They used a small portion of it for Isaiah Hartenstein, but they have most of that mid-level exception left, which gives them a financial leg up on other teams, and assuming they're as good as they look, they should be a contender. So between the opportunity to play for a contender and have the most money, the Rockets are going to have an option to make meaningful additions to this team during the season. So what do they need? Be it more 3-and-D help, some of the names that have been rumored, Trevor Ariza, Damari Carroll, Jared Dudley, those are potential possibilities. Or if they need, say, a backup big, Tyson Chandler, that's a veteran center in Phoenix on the last year of his deal that conceivably could be bought out, those are all various options. Or if they even need more guard help, there are options there as well. Point is, the Rockets as a contender and with more money than most other contenders are going to be in prime position to scoop up whoever the top names are, in the same way they did a year ago with Joe Johnson and Brandon Wright. Unfortunately, for different reasons, those acquisitions didn't turn out as meaningful as a lot of us hoped they would in early February. That said, one of the questions I get a lot on Twitter and on message boards is this player, and we'll start with Ariza, because I think clearly with some questioning whether the Rockets can replace his defense, and the fact that he was such an ideal fit with this team for 4 years, there's a lot of attention paid to that potential scenario. Is he really going to be available? And the same could apply to any potential buyout option, because we're on day one. And with Ariza's situation in particular, you can point to the fact that, look, he was signed by a team that won barely over 20 games last year to a one-year $15 million contract. Why would you sign him to that if you were planning on buying him out? On the surface, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. But what I would remind you going into the season is that teams make these signings thinking about upside scenarios. They're gambles, if you will. In my opinion, the reason the Phoenix Suns, and keep in mind the Suns actually fired the GM in the past few days that signed Ariza and traded for Ryan Anderson. Maybe that changes the calculus a little bit, but we'll have to wait and see what the new regime's outlook is. But effectively, what the Suns did, they brought in these veterans because, sure, they want a culture benefit, they want to show positive examples in training camp and throughout the season to their young players, but what they want to get off is just this treadmill of constant 20-62 seasons, where you're constantly picking in the top three or four. They want to do something to jumpstart that franchise, the same way the Lakers, for example, a year ago, won about 35 games after winning about 25 the year before, and I firmly believe that that's what put them in position to land LeBron James. Now, certainly the market helped. I'm not going to say that if the Lakers didn't play in Los Angeles that they'd still get LeBron. Clearly, LA was part of the package, but if the Lakers had won, say, 20 or 25 games, I'm not sure LeBron, at 34 years old, is willing to take that gamble. Whereas a Laker team that won 35 games and clearly appears on the way up, that's a big difference. If you remember last year, the Lakers, a lot expected them to buy out Brook Lopez. People around the league treated that as an inevitability. They didn't, because they were winning and because they saw value to having a team that could compete and win, you know, 35 plus games and be seen as not a laughingstock. So even though they weren't a playoff team, there are varying degrees to this. So no, I don't think that Phoenix signed Ariza thinking they're going to be a playoff team, because I've seen some folks say, well, even with Ariza and Ryan Anderson, they're not going to make the playoffs, but they still signed him, so why would they release him? No, even if they don't make the playoffs, there are still varying degrees to this. They signed him, in my opinion, hoping that instead of being on this constant treadmill of 20 to 25 win seasons, they see this as an opportunity to break that cycle. And even if they don't make the playoffs, if they can win 10, 15 more games, if they can trend upward, then it's going to make them appealing more so to free agents in future off-seasons or trade targets, whatever it may be. And if that happens, then yeah, I think the Suns would keep Trevor Ariza. And if that happens in Brooklyn, I think they'd keep Jamari Carroll and Jared Dudley, et cetera, et cetera. Because there is value to those scenarios. That said, what if it doesn't? That's the scenario where some of these guys do get bought out. Because keep in mind, entering day one, no team goes into a season thinking, I'm going to buy out this player. Because even bad teams have upside scenarios. Cross-sport analogy. The 2012 Astros, one of the worst teams I've ever seen, they still were almost at 500 through 50 games. That can happen. Even bad teams have upside scenarios, and there's value to those upside scenarios because of the superior PR. Now, short-term, you can sell more tickets, but long-term, it positions your franchise is not just on this constant losing treadmill of 20 and 62 seasons over and over again. You're actually making a move upward. In my opinion, that's what the Suns are counting on with Trevor Ariza, with Ryan Anderson, with Tyson Chandler, these veterans, is that you put together the culture with their young talent, guys like Devin Booker, and that maybe it all comes together. It's not that they're expecting the playoffs, but they're wanting to make a move upward in the standings. And if that's the case, then yeah, they'll keep them. But if it's not, then all of a sudden, look, 6 of the 7 months will have passed almost, because by the buyout deadline, which is the end of February, look, the season's 5 weeks away from ending in early April, so effectively, you know, in terms of culture benefits, all those types of things, you will have already had the player for nearly 6 of the 7 months of the NBA season, and if you think he's going to leave in the summer anyway, then it's not like you're giving up that much. You've already had him for training camp, you've already had most of the so-called culture benefits anyway, and the other thing to remember is that it's not that buyouts are ever to the benefit of the team. No one, or hardly anyone, I should say, thinks, wow, my team is going to be better if I let go of this veteran. No, the reason guys get bought out, like, say, Joe Johnson from Sacramento a year ago, is that it's a favor to the player and more notably his agent, in which a team like Phoenix or Sacramento, whoever it may be, is scratching their back saying, hey, you know, I know this player doesn't really want to be here. He's in a position in his career where he wants to try and win. Well, if I let him free, then remember this. Give me a discount or give me a look for another client of yours in next summer or whatever it may be down the line. So to sum up the calculus on this, it's not so much that the Suns or any team goes into a season thinking that, wow, I'm going to buy out Trevor Ariza come January or February. You have to be open-minded if you're the Rockets or any other potential buyout suitor to the possibility that they might not. That said, these things evolve based on each team's record. Are they trending to be a 20-win team, or are they trending to be a 35-win team? There are varying degrees to this. And again, if you're from the perspective of the Suns, the Nets, whoever it may be, on day one, everyone's optimistic. If you ask not just the Suns, but anyone, do you plan on buying out this player? They're going to say no, because they have to think of the upside scenarios. They have to be diligent and aware of those possibilities because it can help the long-term positioning of their franchise. Just ask the Lakers from a year ago. But if that doesn't happen and all of a sudden you get to late February and the team is acting like it's going to win 20 games, that's what it's tracking towards, and the veteran wants out, and 6 of the 7 months of the NBA season have basically already come and gone, things can change in a heartbeat. So I guess my advice for Rockets fans monitoring the buyout market, it's less about what teams say now in terms of would we conceivably buy out this player or what's the contract status, and it's more about the record. If you want a player, cheer for that team to lose games, cheer for that team to be horrible, because that, more than anything, is going to drive these decisions once January and February get here. So if you want Trevor Ariza, pay attention to the Suns, hope they lose games, hope they're closer to 20 wins than they are 30-plus. Same goes for the Nets and Damari Carroll or any other conceivable buyout candidate and their organization. It's all about how their team fares, and if they lose enough games, any calculus is subject to change on this front. So with that, we'll wrap up today's show. Went a little longer than anticipated, and I don't want to go on too much longer because we will have another episode in the near future breaking down whatever happens Friday night on the court as the Rockets play the Memphis Grizzlies in their preseason finale. So we'll break it right here. If you want more content for the next show, the best place to get it is on Twitter. I'm always on there at Ben Dubose. The show is on there at Locked On Rockets. Also, don't forget email address, lockedonrockets@gmail.com. Facebook account, facebook.com/lockedonrockets. Website, lockedonrockets.com. Always you can access our content, ask me questions about the team, make advertising inquiries, pretty much anything we can do to make this a better podcast for you, the diehard Rockets fan, or you, the human being, don't hesitate to let me know. Also, beyond our own plugs, please check out our sister shows on this great Locked On Podcast Network, Locked On Texans covering the NFL's Houston Texans, Locked On Aggies covering the Texas A&M Athletic Department out of College Station. You can find those Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, Megaphone, TuneIn, wherever you listen to our shows, you can find those and many others covering the NFL, the NBA, some Major League Baseball, and some college sports, because we're all part of this great Locked On Podcast Network with local experts in so many cities across the United States. So for Friday, this will do it. Thanks, as always, for tuning in this week, and stay tuned this weekend where we'll have bonus coverage breaking down whatever happens on the floor when the Rockets meet the Grizzlies Friday night in their preseason finale.